for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
The Spotlight. Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of instrument.
The Spotlight.
A very grim assessment when it comes to the UK's energy bills and, in turn, its economy. Energy bills to rise by over 50% in the month of April, based on the regulator in the UK, which has announced price hikes. An estimated 22 million households will see their energy costs increase. Can these households afford that in the age of COVID? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why rising energy costs are not the only problems plaguing UK's economy, an economy which has not been able to adapt itself since Brexit. Let's get the latest on this. Rob Carter is our correspondent joining us from London. Rob, at this point, looking at this increase of 50%, it's quite incredible. It is set to start in the month of April, but I was under the assumption that the energy costs have risen already. And of course, tell us what the government intends to do, because I think they do have a quick fix for this, in a sense.
Well, energy costs are just one aspect which people are concerned about here in the UK. The price of living in general is on the increase. You'll remember from past reporting that petrol prices are at least four times higher than they were the same time last year. There's also inflation taking place. People are having to pay more in order to get their day-to-day food groceries, among many other things. And this energy bill crisis is just the latest in a long line of increased living costs which are plaguing the country. It's reached a point now where people are very concerned about whether or not they can even pay off their mortgages, meaning that many people going forward may be in a position where they're going to have to choose between either eating a meal, paying their mortgage, or putting the heating on during the cold months. So the situation here is very concerning for the majority of people. The government, of course, is still chewing over what plans is going to take in order to reduce this in the future, but it's the Chancellor and also the Bank of England have been very, very clear that going forward in the immediate terms, things are going to get hard for people, and the government is in no position to deny the fact that people are going to have to pay more, including an increase on immediate bills, including national insurance and things like that. Of course, there are other things which are coming into play over the next few months. Protest movements such as Insulate Britain, which have been long campaigning through direct action to try and force the government to insulate homes, to save people money on their bills and to keep people warm during the cold months. They've announced that they will return to their radical direct action plan going forward, and they intend to be more ambitious than they were last year. And this is the group which, of course, was shutting down motorways, causing major disruption across the UK, and has a very controversial legacy in itself, putting the government in more difficult waters as to dealing with this crisis. So obviously going forward, things are likely to get harder rather than better.
We appreciate it. Okay, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have historian and investigative journalist Tony Gosselin joining us from Bristol. Also joining us, journalist and political commentator Sid Mohsen Abbas, who joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight.
The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
So we have all UK cast here. That's great in this sense. Tony Gosling, let me start with you. We heard our correspondent there. I'm curious about this energy, rise in energy, in particular, I guess, when it comes to households and gas set to increase by 50% based on the stat I'm looking at here. What's interesting here is that the Britain's energy regulator can cap the price, but it couldn't do it beyond the 50% rise. It couldn't cap it or bring down the price or lower it. Is that because the energy companies are privatized and therefore they can't set the price, and that's the best that it could do at this point, the energy regulator?
Well, in a way, you've put your finger on the main problem here, and that is that although they are supposed to be able to regulate the energy market, they can't regulate the energy market, because if all of the energy companies get together and hike up the price of gas, as they have done, so there's much more gas, American gas, going to China at the moment. And as Putin pointed out a couple of months ago, this is the main reason why these energy prices in Europe are going up, because they can't get as much easy, cheap gas as they were doing from the United States. And the fact that this sort of thing is left to the vagaries of a market actually has enabled these energy companies to make vast, vast profits. What we've seen just literally last week announced by Shell, a 14-fold increase, 14 times more profits and money going to their shareholders through share dividends than the previous quarter. So a massive amount of money is being made by these privatized energy companies. What, of course, should happen is that these industries, because they are misbehaving, profiteering off the backs of ordinary working people in Britain, they should be simply renationalised. They should be requisitioned by the government, and then they can start to actually charge the cost price, which is what these utilities should be charging for the energy that people are using. It was interesting. I was just looking at the when it was all privatized. This is the gas and also BP, the golden share in petroleum that was privatized in the Thatcher years. It was NM Rothschild and Sons that managed that privatization. These are very powerful investment bankers. And you have to ask, who's in charge? We ask this all the time with Boris. Who's really running the show? And I think it shows you that the City of London has actually got far more power than the politicians that we elect, when they can be involved in lobbying and arranging for these industries, which we all need, part of our national assets under the ground, to be sold off to private interests. Then also, sure. I would say, we had a couple of months ago fuel shortages orchestrated during the party conference season by the petrol companies here in Britain. So queues outside petrol stations, there was no real fuel shortage. They were doing this deliberately to push the prices up, make more profits, as they've just announced they made, and also to show the world and show the country and show the politicians who's in charge. That is to say that these massive energy conglomerates backed by the City of London are far more powerful than our politicians, I'm afraid.
That's another angle to this, which is very interesting. We're going to get into that. Simon Abbas, taking a look at what is happening to the UK, starting with the topic at hand, which was the energy hike in prices. There's a vast array of, there's so many things that are going wrong for the UK, but this particular one hits UK households pretty hard. 22 million British households are connected to the country's gas grid. Can you give us your assessment of how vast the problem this is?
Well, I think on the ground it's a huge problem, because you know those at the poverty-stricken end, and there's substantial numbers of those in Britain, are going to feel a pinch immediately, because when you're talking about this scale of hike in prices, Of course, people are going to then have to make choices, and the kind of choices they're making are, do I keep my heating on or do I eat food? I mean, these are literally the decisions that many, say, pensioners or people who are unemployed or people who have been, you know, down and out for a while on their luck are having to make. And this is a situation that was entirely avoidable because, you know, of course, we've had the debacle of Brexit, which was a premeditated self-annihilation exercise that Boris was personally very much involved in creating. We've had the supposed Omicron virus preceded by the Delta, preceded by COVID, whatever else it was in its very initiation, which has been a sort of a litany of impending economic disasters that was being built up over that time. So it's hardly a surprise as to what's happening now. Most of us who are in the know have been saying this is exactly what's going to happen. But you can't blame it all on the virus, etc. This is a kind of gross mismanagement on the part of the government. They've underestimated the Brexit scenario quite deliberately, I'd rather suspect.
Sure.
They've underestimated the COVID aspect quite deliberately as well.
Okay. Well, I saw you nodding there, Tony Gosling, except when Simonson Abbas started talking about Brexit. Then you stopped. I'm wondering why. But tell us about Brexit and the promises that Boris Johnson made. He was supposed to cut the VAT on fuel bills. And he has decided not to do that, so which is said to give this rise or be one of the factors for this rise by 54%. Why didn't Prime Minister Johnson follow through with his promise?
Well, of course, it's because Johnson is not necessarily in charge. He has to take advice of the city and his very powerful chancellor, the billionaire Rishi Sunak, the guy from Goldman Sachs. So there are all sorts of people around who've got also a very big say in what goes on. Boris he's being pulled. He's like a tug of war. He's being pulled in various different directions. Sometimes one lobby wins, another time another lobby wins. But I don't think he's a man of specific principles. He's the sort of politician who will try and go with the flow. Whichever way it seems he's going to manage to survive, he will go that way. And so when he's being pulled in this, I mean, it's absolutely right what you're saying about the horrific conditions here in Britain for ordinary people. It's been getting worse really since the 1970s. Slowly but surely, people's living standards have been eroded. Job opportunities are getting worse and worse. The unions are able less and less to keep people's wages at a reasonable level. There's increasing unemployment. There's now the expectation that both the man and the woman in a household must go to work in order to afford to pay, to buy their own home and to make sure kids go to nursery and this sort of thing. So there's massive increases on the finances. But if you look at the structural changes that have been going on, and this is the latest, this really does take the biscuit. I mean, what we've been seeing has gradually been happening over the years. But these fuel increases are a massive increase in that. It's almost an exponential rise. It's because the economy has shifted from a manufacturing and service economy into a financial economy. And what those financial economy, financialized sure. infrastructure, is all the basic things we need, things like housing, water, all the basics. Those is where there's big investment
but that's
and
been going on for a while. But that's been going on for a while, if I'm correct to say that, Tony Gosling, in terms of the UK turning out to become this financial focused economy where the money is made as opposed to what it used to have, which was a lot of manufacturing jobs. But I got to ask this next question from you, Simonson Abbas, because it's very perplexing reading how thousands die because they can't afford heating bills in the UK. More than 2,700 people to have died each year in England and in Wales because they can't afford to keep their homes warm. And then what was more interesting was this is back in 2011. So I'm guessing that figure is higher now. Tell us how this happens and why it seems like the UK government either doesn't care or has learned to adapt to this grim fatality rate as a result, and how much worse it can get with this 54% rise in gas prices or energy prices.
Well, what they've done in Britain since neoliberalism has taken hold of this country in a full way post Thatcher. Margaret Thatcher was the one who ushered it all in back in the 80s. Since then, what we've seen is the delusion of the British, what I still call the working class, because what they were conned into believing was that they'd somehow become middle class, and that they were sort of part of a gravy train which could go and buy their own houses. They could go on several holidays a year. They could expect to spend what they liked in restaurants, go out and have sort of those kind of perks, which I guess people would regard as normal activities now. But of course, for the last 20 years, we've seen that wages haven't been increased, not of the average person. They might have for parliamentarians and others, but for the average person, in real terms, wages haven't gone up. Contrast that with food prices and general cost of living, that's gone up considerably. So you can see that inflation, British households naturally are being hit by inflation, and it's the highest rate of inflation for a decade, as far as I can work out from the research I've done. And of course, that hasn't been arrested by the government. In fact, they've just been printing more money and throwing it at the problem. Now, the thing is, printing money is a habit which has been given to them by the money lenders. And I think Tony was quite right in pointing out to the real problem that Britain has, is that they bought into this idea that you can basically carry on printing your way, printing money out of the problems. Well, sooner or later, any economist knows that that is not going to be the reality of the solution. And until, for instance, a government stops this, and until they invest in real infrastructure, get energy resources. For instance, in this country, why on earth has no government invested in tidal energy? We're surrounded by waves in this little island, and we can produce, I think we produce something like 10% of our natural energy resources a year from tidal waves, etc., and the coast, but we haven't invested in it. We still rely on the carbon.
Well, that could be part of the green movement or actions that is under that umbrella, maybe. I don't have information on that, but you talked about printing money, and of course that's a perfect recipe, Tony Gosling, for inflation, which the UK is experiencing. It's now a 30-year high. Source indicating it's up to about 7%. But is it? I mean, when we hear that, then I'm about to ask you. But haven't prices gone up a lot more? I talked to our correspondent just days ago, and he said price of margarine has quadrupled. I'm wondering what everyday items, how much prices have increased, something that comes at the top of your mind, which then translates to the poor and how they can't afford the amount of price increases that's occurring.
Okay, so I think that actually inflation is not being driven by the quantitative easing, the printing of money, because that's been going on for since really at least 2008, the massive bailouts of the banks that took place then. The reason is because mainly around, I think, energy prices going up, because that has a knock-on effect on everybody. So the food producers have to pay more, so the prices start to go up in the shops. That's, I think, what's causing this inflation. And I would say what we've seen over the last year or so, somewhere between 5 and 10% inflation in basic food prices, the sort of things that people need to survive. That, I think, is been the main driver of the prices going up. But I think there is a bigger problem, and that is this green agenda. We've seen, there's very good aims of the Greens, but we've seen these added extra taxes onto fuel going on because of this. And also, as Mohsin said there, the failure to invest in really good, reliable, cheap green energy like tidal energy. I live in Bristol, which has got one of the highest tidal reaches in the world, along with Newfoundland, and we could very easily have a tidal energy system here. They blocked it time and time and time again, and that's because there's not enough profits in it. There's more profits in the fossil fuel industries, and also there's a whole gravy train developed around other types of green, so-called green energy. So the green thing has been actually a major problem. For example, finding that the electricity grid in Britain can hardly deliver its energy, and we have to switch on the one coal-fired power station we've still got left in order to keep energy going. So that has also been subsidised. Sure. All this green stuff has been subsidised, which has also pushed energy prices up. Remember Henry Kissinger? He said, this is a good few years, probably 30 years ago now, he said, you control the energy, you control the nations. And these energy companies are very powerful, and they work together in concert around the Western world, as you probably know. The other thing he said, by the way, was control the food and you control the people. And so by putting food prices up, make it more difficult to get hold of food, people are being driven in further into debt and into a form of wage slavery.
Right. Well, I'd like to capitalize on what you said in the beginning of the program, Tony Gosselin. I think you mentioned it there a little bit also. And say, Mohsen Abbas, that was when Tony Gosselin talked about Shell. Now, Shell has posted its highest quarterly profits in 8 years. That's a lot. But more alarming is that there wasn't a gas shortage or a petrol shortage. They were just keeping it to drive the prices higher. That is something that is plaguing a lot of different commodities or items, I should say, especially, for example, in the U.S. And I'm wondering if the U.K. is the same case, where because of COVID, people did not go out as much, did not purchase as much maybe, and now it's time to make the money, to make back the profits by increasing the prices even higher, which means the prices are not going to come down. Is that a correct way of looking at it, which means basically corporate greed is playing into the picture?
Very much so, and I think let's take it a step up now, because Vanguard and BlackRock, according to my research, are two companies who basically overarch most of the financial capital and the corporations of the world. Now, if we're living in the alternate reality where I'm meant to believe that there's free competition, free trade, and there's real corporations out there which are all fighting each other, then I could accept that, okay, there's a dog-eat-dog world out there. But I've increasingly started studying people like Professor Rodney Shakespeare and his take on binary economics and the solutions, and researching things like, for instance, the Bradbury Pound, which was something which Britain used as a way of kicking out the corporates, looking back at the way America once dealt with bankers as well. There is a precedent for solving these problems. And the precedent begins, first of all, with stopping the reliance on the guys who create the main debt, who use usury and use the interest mechanisms and the money system as a way of making all these things happen. And of course, energy companies and all these different corporates that fix the prices and sort of sit behind closed doors and decide what's going to happen, what's not going to happen, then they come into play. But behind, let's take it another stage further back and look at the World Economic Forum, for example. Mr. Klaus Schwab, who has been harping on about the Agenda 2030 and the Great Reset, the Global Reset. And all of this involves the biggest transnational corporations in the world, whether there's two of them or dozens of them or whatever you believe. And it involves the state operators. These are clear-cut strategies and policies which hinge around...
I wonder if there was a bidding for that. It makes me wonder if there was a bidding for that to become part of this, as you said, great 2030 reset.
Well, yes. I mean, the thing is, if you believe in accidents and chaos in the economic world, then of course you just see things as a matter of symptoms and consequence and reactionary behavior. Sure. But if you start seeing that actually there are players that have power to be able to influence those the economics, i.e. they control the means of production, they control the raw materials, they can create wars where they want, they can release viruses if they wanted to create chaos around the world, and they can also create propaganda
okay.
and create corporate
I got to jump in. Unfortunately, we're just running out of time, Sir Mohsen Abbas. I do apologize. And I figure I'm going to save this one for last, Tony Gosselin. And this is what Rishi Sunak has said. The government does have a plan to help out, I guess, with the energy bills for average UK. But then he said, in terms of taxes, his mission was to cut taxes ahead of the next general election, scheduled for May 2024. Well, that's 2 years from now. How's that going to help people now?
Well, you know what? Today, Rishi Sunak has just blocked a recovery plan for the National Health Service, too. I think if I was Boris Johnson, I would sack him today, because he's clearly showing policies which are simply there to beef up the profits of the biggest companies in the City of London. For example, Shell, their 14-fold rise in profits at the same time as the energy prices are going up for
okay.
consumers 50%.
Thank you for
now,
that.
This
I'm
really
sorry,
is.
Tony Gosselin, we're just out of time.
Taking,
I do apologize. Thank you so
now.
Much. It was very riveting. This was great. Tony Gosselin there, sorry, investigative journalist from Bristol. Thank you so much for your contribution. And Sir Mohsen Abbas from London, thank you. Journalist and political commentator, also from London there. And that is it for this edition of The Spotlight. From me, Kaveh Tahlai, it's goodbye until next time.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وقال الذين لا يرجون لقاءنا لولا أنزل علينا الملائكة أو نرى ربنا لقد استكبروا في أنفسهم وعتوا عتوا كبيرا.
And those who do not expect the meeting with us say, Why were not angels sent down to us? Or why do we not see our Lord? They have certainly become arrogant within themselves and become insolent with great insolence.
As you have been with us, dear listeners, we were discussing the 21st verse of the chapter. وَقَالَ الَّذِينَ لَا يَرْجُونَ لِقَاءَنَا لَوْلَا أُنزِلَ عَلَيْنَا الْمَلَائِكَ أَوْ نَرَى رَبَّنَا And those who do not hope to meet us say, Why are not the angels sent down to us? Or do we not see our Lord? لَقَدْ اسْتَكْبَرُوا فِي أَنفُسِهِمْ وَعَتَوْا عُتُوًا كَبِيرًا Certainly, they are too proud of themselves, and they have revolted in great revolt. We said that these baseless words and pretexts they're seeking, they are originating from unbelief in resurrection. They don't want to undertake the responsibilities to the Almighty Allah. And that's why in the different verses of the Holy Quran, the different pretexts of these people have been mentioned. But a person who seeks truth only demands reason for proving a matter. He does not care about the sort of reason, whatever kind it may be. When by performing miracles, including the Holy Quran itself, the Prophet ﷺ has proved that his call, that his invitation is right, what do these pretexts mean? In fact, the best reason that these words were not uttered for the sake of researching on the prophethood of the Holy Prophet, is that they asked to see Allah. And by this demand, they reduced him to a visible object. This groundless demand was asked by the children of Israel, and its decisive answer has been given to them in the Holy Quran, in chapter A'raf. Anyway, the Holy Quran answers these demands in this way. لَقَدْ اسْتَكْبَرُوا فِي أَنفُسِهِمْ Certainly, they're too proud, highly of themselves. وَعَتَوْا عَتُوًّا كَبِيرًا and have revolted in great revolt. The Arabic word otub means the worst kind of oppression. These are the ones who have oppressed against the revelations of the Holy Prophet. الَّذِينَ لَا يَرْجُونَ لِقَاءَنَا They do not believe in resurrection.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
The day of resurrection is called the day of Liqa in this verse because in that day all ignorance and negligence and obstacles will be removed fully and people can see Almighty Allah's magnificence. But these unbelievers about whom the Holy Quran says لَقَدْ اِسْتَكْبَرُوا فِي أَنفُسِهِمْ They are too proud of themselves, do not want to meet their lords. Brothers and sisters, in our age, you may have heard some people repeating the logic of the previous polytheists and say that they do not believe in Almighty Allah unless they see Allah in their laboratory, unless they see Allah in their experiments in the soul or in surgery operations. The source of both is one thing, arrogance, as this verse mentions, and delusion. Well, it seems that all the people who know only sense and experience as the only means of recognition, implicitly they are repeating this very matter. All materialists, all the money-minded people do have this same opinion, but our sense can perceive only a small part of this world. This is what they need to understand. You cannot achieve everything only through your sense. Anyway, all materialists count everything unspiritual and earthy as they try to see Allah with their own physical eyes. And this is their great mistake. This is what has misguided the people. This is the origination of people being misled by some others. Which itself originate from, as the verse says, لَقَدْ اِسْتَكْبَرُوا فِي أَنفُسِهِمْ This comes from being highly proud of oneself. And this is what it results in, unbelief in hereafter. We ask the Almighty Allah to keep us away from the ones who do not believe in hereafter. In fact, we have to try to answer these pretexts using the verses of the Holy Quran. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care. Goodbye.
The very first revolution that started with the people, continued with the people, did not change its word, did not change its way, did not decrease or increase its goals, is the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei.
Of Jalali Tehran.
Rubashavik Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Police violence targeting black people has once again brought Americans to the streets in the northern city of Minneapolis, which is still reeling from the police murder of George Floyd, a black man, in 2020. This time, the victim is Amir Locke, a 22-year-old African-American who was killed when police stormed into his apartment without warning on Wednesday. Hundreds of protesters rallied in the city, calling for the arrest of officers involved in the shooting and an end to discriminatory law enforcement tactics. Similar protests were held in New York City. The officers were carrying out a no-knock search warrant on the apartment. The city's mayor has now announced a suspension of no-knock warrants that have been at the center of heated debates over rising police violence. Back in 2020, the city restricted the use of such unannounced raids as part of a series of reforms that were introduced following mass anti-racism protests.
They barge in before they ever identify themselves, and they give Amir no time to save his own life. And that's something that we don't see white citizens encounter. And the fact that it's happening in Minneapolis again is beyond tragic. It's abhorrent.
Locke's parents say their son was a beloved member of his community and a law-abiding citizen.
I believe that he was executed by the MPD, and I want the police officer that murdered my son to be prosecuted and fired.
Yes.
Locke's death has reopened the wounds caused by the murder of Floyd and a dozen of other recent victims. Official figures show that black men are three times more likely than white men to be killed by police during their lifetime. But police bullets, batons, or knees are not the only concerns to African Americans. The deep-rooted anti-black racism also shows itself in inadequate access to health care, food, housing, and jobs. In 2020, the injustices long felt by African Americans triggered a nationwide protest movement challenging police brutality and bias in the U.S. criminal justice system. And that movement transformed into a global campaign to fight racism and build a world free of discrimination and supremacist ideologies.
Israel once again at the heart of an international rift and controversy, this time within a usually united body valuing consensus, the African Union. A row so fierce that the bloc was forced to suspend a debate on whether to rescind Israel's observer status and postpone a potentially divisive vote. The rare dispute within the 55-member body was set in motion last July. That's when Moussa Faki Mahamat, the chairman of the African Union Commission, unilaterally accepted Israel's accreditation to the bloc. A slew of criticism followed. Powerful members, including South Africa and Algeria, were among the many protesting that the decision had been taken without consultations. They also argued that the decision flew in the face of African Union statements supporting the Palestinian territories. The AU has called for an end to the Israeli occupation and an independent Palestinian state, with East Al-Quds as its capital. Israel received AU observer status after 20 years of diplomatic efforts. The quest is largely seen as part of the regime's US-backed campaign to normalize ties with African and Arab countries such as Morocco, Sudan, the UAE, and Bahrain. But analysts believe the normalization does not enjoy popular support.
Of course, Israel has hitherto been, of course, unaccepted in Asia or in West Asia. And although you've got clandestinely nations like Saudi Arabia who have been dealing with it, and others more over, like Jordan and Egypt, etc., you've nonetheless got this kind of fear amongst leaderships in West Asia, even now, of openly becoming part of the Israeli syndicate. Because the people, ultimately at the grassroots, certainly the Arab people, are not happy with the idea of Israel being accepted.
Palestine gained observer status at the African Union in 2013. Its Prime Minister, Mohamed Shtaya, addressed the bloc's latest summit held at the weekend. He called for Israel's accreditation to be revoked.
Israel should never be rewarded for its violation and for the apartheid regime it does impose on the Palestinian people. As an entity, Israel has progressed from extremism to militarism to colonial expansion. This must stop.
Resistance movement Hamas has also slammed granting Israel the observer status. Hamas says the move is a flagrant violation of the principles and statute of the African Union, which reject racism and demand decolonization and the right to self-determination. The African body has now set up a six-country committee to review Israel's observer status and submit its findings during an assembly next year, a decision that will ultimately come down to whether or not the bloc will stick to its anti-colonial and anti-racist principles.
When the Iranian Islamic Revolution took place in 1979, prominent Nigerian Islamic cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki was a young university student preaching against immorality. He says that the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran and the leader of the revolution, Imam Khomeini, were sources of inspiration to many young Nigerians.
It makes us, you know, it boosts our morale and it makes us feel that what we have been yearning and aspiring is realizable. It's possible since it has been realized elsewhere. You know, the success of the revolution was, a turning point in modern history.
Professor Sadiq Abba was also a young student who cared about the common good for all Nigerians and said that the Islamic Revolution was based on knowledge and the collective willpower on the Iranian people.
The Iranian revolution is a revolution that sprang up to address global injustice, global inequalities, and global socioeconomic exploitation and expropriations by the Western world.
Dr. Imam Mukhtar says the 1979 Islamic Revolution was a change that was inspired by Iranians who have had enough.
It was a unique revolution that was led and driven by individuals, groups, young people and old alike, who saw a frustration with the system, which was with the Shah regime, which was not only pro-West, but then subduing the people within the domestic environment. And it was a collective responsibility.
Experts believe that one of the significant outcomes of the 1979 Islamic Revolution was turning Iran into a power in the Middle East region with even influence in global affairs. Anjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
When Saudi Arabia launched an air campaign on Yemen in March 2015, it assured the U.S. administration of President Barack Obama that it would oust the Ansarullah movement within months. But the war, aimed at restoring a former friendly government in the Yemeni capital Sana'a, dragged on with limited military gains. Under Obama, whose government had close bonds with Saudi Arabia, indiscriminate and disproportionate airstrikes continued on Yemen. Homes, markets, schools, hospitals, weddings, and funerals were targeted with U.S.-made weapons, including widely banned cluster munitions. An all-out Saudi blockade exacerbated Yemen's health and nutrition crises, and diseases like cholera began to spread like wildfire. And all those happened amid military and diplomatic support provided by the Obama administration. The U.S. also stood silent in 2016 when Saudi Arabia, through threats of cutting funds to the UN, finally forced the world body to drop it from its list of the worst offenders against children for its attacks on Yemeni kids. Obama lost all chances to stop the slaughter. Donald Trump followed in the footsteps of his predecessor in supporting Saudi Arabia and made his first trip as U.S. president to the Arab Kingdom. Hours after landing at the Saudi capital Riyadh on the 20th of May 2017, Trump sealed a $350 billion arms deal with King Salman, the largest in world history. The transaction included tanks, combat ships, missile defense systems, as well as radar, communications, and cybersecurity technology. 2 years later, the U.S. president vetoed a bipartisan resolution to force stop America's involvement in Yemen's bloodshed. Like Obama, Trump, too, missed all the chances to end the slaughter.
This war has to end.
That's what incumbent Joe Biden said last year, just weeks into his presidency, announcing an end to U.S. assistance for Saudi Arabia's offensive operations in Yemen, as well as relevant arms sales. However, months later, that promise was broken as his government approved two arms deals worth over $1 billion. To support the United Arab Emirates against Yemen's retaliatory attacks, the U.S. is now deploying a destroyer and fighter jets in the UAE, a key member of the Saudi-led military coalition. France also says it'll give military support to the UAE to help it protect its airspace. The Biden administration is also planning to bring Yemen's Ansarullah movement back on a U.S. blacklist. Aid organizations warn that the move would prevent the delivery of critical humanitarian assistance to millions of innocent people and could have adverse humanitarian consequences.
It will have much effect on Yemeni civilians because many UN agency and NGOs are working in Yemen. If the United States will continue or if they will declare the Houthi as a terrorist group, this will have a huge and a bad effect on Yemeni civilians.
By sticking to warmongering policies, the current U.S. president is also missing on his chances to stop the war. a conflict that the UN says has already turned Yemen into the largest humanitarian crisis in the world.
The European Union Agency for Asylum, EUAA, says new refugee applications in the 27-country bloc are at a five-year high, mainly being submitted by Afghans and Syrians. On Wednesday, 19 refugees were found dead on the border between Turkey and EU nation Greece. It's believed they died from hypothermia. The European Commission claims it's trying to gather further information. EU Home Affairs ministers have been meeting to try and advance the bloc's new refugee policy, known as the Migration Pact.
The strategy of all or nothing up to now has actually given us nothing, and this is not good for member states or the European Union. We want to breathe new life into the EU Migration Pact.
When it comes to the refugee crisis, civil society organizations and many EU lawmakers make the point that the West never learns from its mistakes. They are expressing concern that stoking tensions with Russia over Ukraine has the potential to create a new refugee crisis. It's suggested war hawks in the US and NATO don't give a damn about the millions of people who have been displaced through military intervention in countries such as Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, and Libya. As the EU's Poland and Lithuania construct a new wall along their borders with Belarus, the European Commission is promising billions of euro to expand and arm the bloc's border agency, Frontex.
Frontex is by far the biggest agency we ever had. And we are setting it up right now, and it's huge. It's going to have 10,000 armed people at our external borders.
The EU's own data shows 100,000 children and teenagers go missing in the bloc every year. Most of those are refugees. Campaigners are calling for greater cooperation between police forces.
There need to be better information sharing platforms so we know exactly how many children are going missing and what are the actual risks that they face, because right now, nobody knows.
With EU nations refusing to take in refugees, and as billions are spent on keeping them out, rights groups are again asking, where are the bloc's much trumpeted values? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
In overcrowded dinghies and often in the cover of darkness, migrants, among them people running away from wars and instability, take to the choppy waters separating France from the UK. Some make it. Others die trying. 27 of them in November last year alone. An incident that further strained the fragile ties between Paris and London. French President Emmanuel Macron says Britain's reliance on illegal immigrant labor is behind the surge in numbers crossing from France and in their deaths.
I think it's definitely political because he's getting set to run his election campaign. You know, we've had Brexit as well, so we know that that has impacted, but the reality is we're talking about human beings. So this is not about political point scoring, or it shouldn't be about political point scoring between governments.
Britain says the French president is absolutely wrong, that the government here is searching for ways to stop the crossings. This is what Interior Minister Priti Patel had to say in the wake of those tragic deaths in November.
We're not working just to end these crossings because we don't care or we're heartless. There's no quick fix. This is about addressing long-term pull factors, smashing criminal gangs that treat human beings as cargo, and tackling supply chains.
To do that, Britain wants France to let British police patrol French beaches. It has ruled out physically pushing boats back across the English Channel. It wants to give people traffickers life sentences and has introduced a controversial bill that will allow it to send migrants to detention centers in other countries. To campaigners, that is draconian and racist.
The Nationality and Borders Bill seeks to make it even more difficult for people to seek asylum in Britain, which again is a contravening international human rights laws. It will also mean that there's a higher scrutiny of people. There are tighter deadlines as it stands.
More than 28,000 migrants crossed the English Channel in 2021, triple the number the year before.
And while British and French leaders continue to trade accusations, more desperate migrants will embark on that perilous journey across the English Channel, and that will almost certainly mean more deaths. Saeed Pourriza, London.
It is the revolution that continues to reverberate around the globe. Iran's Islamic Revolution ushering in a new age by ousting the US-backed Pahlavi regime. Father Frank Gelly, who became an ordained minister, recalls his initial reaction when news of the revolution broke.
At the time, I considered myself quite left-wing, so I enjoyed the idea there should be a revolution against the Shah. I considered the Shah a tyrant.
One of the most inspirational things about the Islamic Revolution for its many admirers is not just the impact that it's had inside of Iran, but it's the growing legacy that it continues to build globally.
For political observers, Iran's stoic path proved an innovative and bold new model where alliances could be forged and solidarity fostered.
Because of its anti-imperialistic values, that's why Iran has good relations with lots of other countries around the world, Muslim and non-Muslim, that have also suffered colonialism and occupation. I mean, it could be Cuba, it could be Venezuela, many countries in Africa around the world who, you know, have a certain affinity with Iran because of that.
There's also another element to those who admire the aims and accomplishments of the revolution.
The Iranian revolution, as I mentioned, it tells us how you don't have to have only one model of political system whereby, I mean, here in this country we have a monarch who is head of a national church, but it's a farce. In reality, God has been pushed out of a public sphere, and so the whole thing is a charade. In Iran, there is a valuable presence of faith in the public sphere.
As the revolution moves towards another remarkable milestone, the West still continues its opposition campaign despite a lack of success.
I can't think of too many examples of countries around the world that have withstood the barrage of war, sanctions, media hatred, internal subterfuge, you know, kind of instigated from outside, that Iran has. Yet they're still here, and they're not just surviving by the skin of their teeth, they're thriving as well. They have a strong military, they have strong regional allies, they have political influence, especially within their area in the Middle East. I think that it's widely recognized, even by haters of Iran, that Iran is one of the major regional players.
With its legacy still rippling across the globe, supporters of the Islamic Revolution internationally know they owe Iran and Iranians a great debt. Amina Taylor, London. Come April, many Britons will have to choose between heating and eating. Everything from bus fares to mortgages are going to cost more. Interest rates have gone up twice in 7 weeks, and three more hikes are on the horizon as the central bank tries to tackle the situation. The opposition members of parliament are livid, saying the government is incompetent.
He doesn't like it, Mr. Speaker, when children in my constituency go to bed with no food in their tummies, with no heat in their homes. What does he really think is the honourable position of a Chancellor who has just allowed one of his policies directly to be taken in fraud, £4.3 billion of fraud under his watch? Any other Chancellor that I've known would come to the House today to resign.
This week, millions learnt that their gas and electricity bills are going to jump 54%. The government says there's nothing it can do with energy prices going up worldwide.
I don't believe them at all. You know, I'm sure they know, you know, and this is just to people.